happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, it's Commentary Day. Commentaries that I've written, as well as others. The health and nutrition part of our program? Absolutely. We're going to show you what just 60 seconds of exercise will do. We're also going to explore the whole area of herbs. Today's herb, well, it's a root. It's called burdock, and it's not being consumed. Should be. Also, a lot of people are giving their pets Prozac. That's just medical insanity. And let's take a look at male menopause, why we don't talk about it and should, and how it actually kind of creeps up on men slowly. But then when it's in its full force, you're impotent, you're detached from people, your relationships suffer, your body begins to break down, you become more susceptible to disease. Well, we can reverse all that, and I'll show you how. But today I'm going to deal with probably 10 to 15 different areas, all of them important because they're not getting the right attention. For example, I was inviting children from inner city environments to come up to my farm in Stone Ridge back in the 1970s. And there would be sometimes on a Saturday or Sunday as many as 500 people visiting. And we'd have all kinds of things, show them how to milk goats and make goats' milk and cheese, which they would get, and tofu we'd make. Showed them about herbs and gardening. Everybody would take home a big bag of something that we were growing or making. And people loved it. And I encouraged the school teachers who are friends of mine and also in this audience, let's begin the process of getting children as part of the curriculum back into nature. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. But here's what could happen, and this is going to be rewilding the child with George Monbiot. You'll enjoy this. Also, the pharmaceutical industry. Let me show you how much power it has, how much control it has over the FDA. We just found out that the pharmaceutical firms paid to attend meetings of panels that advise the FDA. $25,000 a person for just a meeting. But that's how the pharmaceutical industry tells the FDA through its selected experts what drugs should be and should not be greenlighted. So it's controlling everything. Also, for all of you parents who listen worldwide, who've had a child diagnosed as autistic, and we're told, well, the CDC and the FDA and U.S. Public Health Services, there's no connection between the vaccines and autism. And what is their proof? Well, the proof is that there were outstanding studies, 21 out of 23 done by just one doctor, Paul Thorson, and they disproved any link. Today, a reexamination of that evidence. And it shows just the opposite. Oh, and by the way, Paul Thorson, the one and only person in all of science and all the government who's been held up as the expert that there's no association, he's a criminal. He's on the run. Wow, he's right up there on the most wanted list. Yeah. Well, that means then surely the CDC rebuked all of his research. No, they didn't. We'll get into that. But parents, you were right. We'll give you the proof on that. From our environmental segment today, from Chris Takoff, radioactive water from fracking found in Pennsylvania streams, big time. From Jim Hightower, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a corporate coup in disguise. From Harvard, we are drastically overprescribing ineffective antibiotics. And if you want to know why we have the Ted Cruz and some other very powerful right-wing zealot Republicans championing the cause of get rid of the government, accept the military-industrial complex, bigger Defense Department, bigger Security Department, bigger spying, more spying, and more control over the citizens, but we are also constitutionalists. Well, boy, there's an oxymoron. A commentary, The Radical Christian Right and the War on Government, Chris Hedges, Truth Dig. I've been doing a series now for 2 years on America is now a full-fledged fascistic state, and it is also a police state. Not becoming, it is now. 2 years ago, I couldn't find a single report that would support this. Last week, there were over 100 reports. This week, there's over 30. Today, from Michael Shank and Elizabeth Beavers from The Guardian, quote, America's police are looking more and more like the military. Oh, you bet. Now, I won't have time today, but tomorrow I'll be going more in depth talking about martial law and the economy from Professor Ellen Brown, Global Research. Is our homeland security preparing for the next Wall Street collapse? Now, she's a scholar. She is methodical. She's always been right, and she believes that we are preparing for martial law, and that's why we are militarizing the police. Also, the U.S. and European Union Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, what is called TAFTA, it's nothing more than a big business power grab. And with rise of American fascism, shut down police politics, predictable, call new progressive era rise from ashes for obstructionism, or is it the descent of American democracy just beginning? This is from Common Dreams. Again, it deals with a new fascism. So as you see, we have a whole lot to share. And I select each topic based upon what I do not hear. I refuse to do what's on Democracy Now! I will never do what's on MSNBC or Fox because I consider all of them biased. And a half-truth is a full lie, according to an old Jewish statement. So one just lobs challenges at the other, and I'm looking for something that actually allows us a more independent way of looking at the truth. That said, let's start with health and nutrition. A new study, and a really good study, from the University of Utah, says that every minute of intense exercise reduces obesity risk by 5%. That means that we're not exercising intense exercise schemes. We're doing lazy, or what I call junk exercise. Have you ever seen those people in the gyms reading a newspaper and just spinning their legs? That's junk exercise. It's functionally worthless. You have to put it on highest resistance possible. If you're on a step machine, the highest resistance, the highest elevation. So you really struggle. It is the resistance of the struggle that makes a difference. This is a separate article, and here's what it says. Which is more important to your health, how long you exercise or how much effort you put into it? According to the latest research, the more intense your exercise, the more productive it is. Every minute counts. No need for an hour-long class or walking several miles. They say you can get all the fitness you need in short bursts of intense exercise throughout the day. About 150 minutes of intense exercise per week, split into about 10 minutes each time, is ideal. Walk power walking, that's ideal. The study looked at the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, analyzed about around 4,500 people. And it's the low time, high intense exercise. That's what makes the difference. Interesting, because I led a workshop this morning with John Q, where we put people in 10-minute bursts of high-intense exercise where they really felt the muscles burn. That is better than an hour of taking it easy. The first time I had burdock, B-U-R-D-O-C-K, burdock root, was in a macrobiotic restaurant called the Sioux Inn up on Broadway. The Sioux Inn still exists. I think there are a couple downtown. They're really good macrobiotic restaurants. And I didn't understand how they got the taste the way they did, but it was soft, chewy, and had kind of a salty taste to it. And then I started to read up on it, and I said, wow, this has a lot of medicinal value to it. Today, most people do not eat burdock, but they should. Why? The burdock root is a part of a family that can be found in various places around the world, in Europe, in Southeast Asia, even in North America. And you may also already know of some other closely related herbs from this extended family, like chamomile, yarrow, chicory, thistle, and echinacea. And burdock is essentially composed of carbohydrates and volatile oils. That's where you get your kind of tartness, plus plant sterols, tannins, and fatty oils. Like many medicinal herbs, some of its incredible health benefits originate from its powerful antioxidants, like quercetin and lutein. These are the main phenolic acids working wonders inside your body. Burdock was a very popular herb with Native Americans. They would always make sure to have it available all year round, and they stored up on it in winter months. And you saw that it's cleansing, it purifies the blood, it relieves the body of toxins. It's a great detoxificant. It's a natural diuretic, and it can be applied to the skin for patients with eczema, acne, and psoriasis as a paste. In fact, people living in Japan and other parts of Europe simply eat it as a vegetable. It's great for digestion thanks to its inulin, N-I-N-U-L-I-N, U-L-I-N, inulin. It's a very quality fiber. And it works to various degrees of efficacy. It can help with gallstones, kidney stones, heart disease, cancer, high blood sugar, bacterial skin infections, sore throats, and colds. Now, this inulin, as I mentioned a moment ago, is great for digestion because it enhances bacterial flora. It promotes a decent sugar level for diabetes. It can help lower blood pressure, and that is terrific. It also has what are called polyacetylenes. Now, these are strong antibacterial, and they help topically with boils and acne on the skin. If you have a toenail infection, and if you made a poultice out of burdock, by adding also 5 drops of colloidal silver, 5 drops of tea tree oil, and 1 teaspoon of manuka honey, you blended all that together, and then you put that around the toe with the infection, and then put a sock on it, and you leave it overnight. That helps to heal the fungal properties because the polyacetylenes are antifungal. And there's also the benefit of helping with antiviral, anti-cancer properties. So our herb of the day, which is a wonderful herb and edible root, is burdock. Recently, someone approached me on the street in New York and said they have a dog that's very hyper, and they started giving their dog Prozac. And what did I think of that? And I said, well, some dogs, based upon their breed, are naturally hyper, and other dogs, based upon how they're treated, are naturally hyper. But you can change that. You do not need Prozac, because Prozac has devastating effects. Well, according to some of the latest research, lots of people are giving their pets Prozac, and that's not a good thing. The side effects are horrific, just like they are in human beings. And I believe that you should never be medicating your pets with mood-altering drugs, because it's only going to make problems worse. And you can end up with liver failure, kidney failure, and they can actually create hyper-anxiety in dogs. They can create additional stress. They're going to have weight gain. Your dog's going to become obese. It increases urination and defecation, and you're going to be going to the vet. You don't need to put your dogs on Prozac. Now, finally, what is male menopause? I had a group of men about 10 years ago that were in a study. There were about 300 of them. And on the very first night of the study, and we were meeting once a week for 1 year, I asked them, what are your most common symptoms that you find at this point in your life that you did not have previous? And here's what they said. Losing muscle mass, skin starting to shrivel and hang, a loss of vitality, energy, inability to sleep through the night, lots of urination waking up at night, loss of libido, and that was universal, the inability to maintain an erection, emotional withdrawal, and that also was universal. About 95% of the men said that the people who were closest to them, that they cared about and valued, they no longer had that connection. They thought something was terribly wrong with them. And so what did they do? More often than not, they retreated into their own man cave shell. One man said that he just would lose himself in reading because he did not want to or feel comfortable communicating any longer. And they generally were accused of being selfish emotionally and going through midlife crisis and wanting to recreate their youth. And there was not a whole lot of empathy or understanding of their condition. When I explained that what they were suffering from was almost identical to what women suffered from, with some exceptions. But the women go through weight gain, men the same, loss of muscle mass, mood swings, irritability, depression, emotional withdrawal, hypermania, fatigue is common, insomnia is common, digestive problems are common. And so those are virtually identical in the men and the women. Now, finally, mainstream medicine has acknowledged this. In fact, this is from Medical News Today. Let me read this. Is the male menopause myth a reality? When men reach their late 40s to early 50s, some may experience a reduction in libido, sex drive, erectile dysfunction, weight gain, fatigue, depression, and other emotional symptoms which bear some similarities to the female menopause. However, the female menopause is completely different. By the way, I would disagree with that completely. They've never done a study. They have not reversed it. Quote, in a woman, the menopause marks the time when her menstrual period stops and she no longer is able to become pregnant. Her levels of female hormones, estrogen, progesterone, decline considerably. That also is not true. You get a woman who's on a high-protein diet, who's overweight and anxious, watch the estrogen levels go up, and that makes her more susceptible to heart attack, breast cancer, and ovarian cancer. Well, they have not done their homework here. Among males, quote, the male menopause is much less abrupt. The signs and symptoms merge more gradually and subtly. And the decrease in male hormone testosterone levels is nowhere near as steep as it isn't for women. Do doctors use the term male menopause? No. A healthcare professional may use the term andropause, testosterone deficiency, or late state hypogonadism, and which refers to the deficiency in male hormone. The meaning of late onset condition is more similar to that what lay people in the media refer to when discussing male menopause. So let's take a look at the World Health Organization. It does not recognize the term andropause, but does recognize menopause in women. Well, hello. Since when has the World Health Organization ever got anything right? These clowns are nothing more than an extension of the pharmaceutical industry, and everyone in this audience already knows that. According to the Cleveland Clinic, healthcare professionals are currently debating whether males really go through a well-defined menopause. Yeah. And does that mean that if the Cleveland Clinic experts say, we don't believe there's such thing as male menopause, then it must not exist, because who are we to suggest that these astute men from the Cleveland Clinic are not the wisest men in the world? I think they're a bunch of idiots, but that's just, hey, that's my bias. Of course there's male menopause, and I don't have anyone to tell me, nor any other man to tell us, that when we're going through something, we're going through it. We're not a bunch of sheep that need some medical doctor. Did I miss it? Did I miss the fact that we spend $3 trillion, that's with a T, trillion a year, on a medical-industrial complex, and yet they, the medical-industrial complex, managed to kill more people who could have been alive than heart disease or cancer or stroke, and they take no responsibility for it, but they're paid for it and rewarded for it and acknowledged in kind of a supreme way for it. And yet they're always 30 years behind every single reality when it comes to health. So for the men in this audience, here's what we do know. You can go through hot flashes. In the UK, they call them flushes. You will go through moodiness and irritability. You will go through fat redistribution, muscle loss, dry skin, thin skin. You will go through excessive sweating. You'll have a reduced concentration span. You'll lose enthusiasm for everything. Now, a European study led by researchers from the University of Manchester and Imperial College London and the University College London identified the symptoms of male menopause. The study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, but wouldn't you think that people at the Cleveland Clinic would have read it? The World Health Organization would have read that? Not an obscure publication. It's one of the top 10 scientific publications, medical publications in the world, New England Journal of Medicine. And these are no slouchers at the Imperial College London, University College London. So here's what's official in the article. Quote, decreased frequency of morning erection, erectile dysfunction, impotency, problems getting and maintaining erection, decreased sex drive, inability to walk more than 1 kilometer, inability to engage in vigorous activity, such as running or lifting heavy objects, inability to bend, knee to stoop, loss of energy, sadness, fatigue. So, whether they choose to call it andropause or male menopause, it exists, and we can change it. How do we change it? Well, first, by starting to detoxify. And also, when you have male menopause, you're more susceptible to heart and cardiovascular disease, obesity, depression and anxiety, type 2 diabetes. First and foremost, get your testosterone checked. The lower the free testosterone, the more symptoms you're going to have. Now, with crisin, that's with a CH, with phytonutrients, let me make it real simple. If you begin a vigorous program of exercising 6 days a week, an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening, cardiovascular aerobic in the morning, resistance in the evening, that's one big thing that will help regain some human growth hormone, muscle mass, testosterone. Get rid of meat and all dairy, wheat and all sugars, coffee and artificial sweeteners. That helps create a better pH in the body. Start taking in quality protein shakes twice a day. I suggest about 30 grams twice a day from split pea or hemp or brown rice or non-GMO organic soy. The more berries you eat, the better it is if you're a man. Blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, strawberries, boysenberries, black currants, tart cherries, all are great for you. Papaya, pineapple, great for you. So then take 1 tablespoon a day of black cumin seed oil. Take 2 of the 1,000-unit the omega-3 fatty acids, or if you're taking it liquid form, you can take a tablespoon. make sure you're getting a 50 milligram B complex, vitamin C, ideally about 10,000 milligrams a day, and about 5,000 milligrams of quercetin. And juicing as much as you can. Coenzyme Q10 at about 300 to 500 milligrams a day, and NADH at 50 to 100 milligrams a day, and PPQ 20 milligrams three times a day. Then you'll start to see the biochemistry changing. Try that for the next 4 weeks. Then I'll give you an additional protocol that specifically targets. Oh, and throw in some zinc each day as well. That'll make a difference. And L-carnosine, 1,000 milligrams of carnosine, 15 to 30 milligrams of zinc a day will make a difference. For your bones and your muscles, 1,000 milligrams of calcium magnesium from citrate, and get a complex so that way you get something that also has some vitamin D3, vitamin K, boron, and which is also part of it, manganese. 4 weeks from now, I'll give you part two. There'll be four parts to this, and every month for 4 months, I'll add on to this. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with commentaries. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. Nice to have you with us today. By the way, for those of you who are seeking to have some guidance, getting yourself healthy, losing weight, getting more energy, helping with pains and fatigues, I've just hired someone new to help you because we've had so many people who want this help, and I believe we've helped between 25 to 30,000 people. So now we have our newest person working on Saturdays from 10 in the morning till 7 at night is Danny Jacobs. Now, many of you know Danny Jacobs, and you've probably in the past been counseled by him. Danny's one of the nicest people that you'll meet. He's a nutritionist. He's also a lawyer, and he gave up his practice of law because he wanted to do more to help people. And he's there on Saturdays. He's free. I pay him a nice salary. So you don't have to pay him anything. And then during the week and the evenings, you've got Larry, master's degree from, I think it's in New York University, he's a registered dietitian, nutritionist. So all these people have great backgrounds. We screen them carefully. And each and every one is there to help you. So if you'd like some free help, counseling, you go there. They generally give you a half hour of their time for free. And they help a lot of people because I see the feedback. And again, it costs you nothing. It's a public service. I pay for it because long ago I realized there were just too many people wanting help and I couldn't help everyone. So I chose to help those who were facing death, who had been given up, who were terminal. And those are the only people I personally see. But all the other people can be seen by these people. So give a call. And if you want to see the newest one, Danny, or any of them, you can see Dr. Nadia, who's a psychologist, by the way. And she's really good helping people with weight problems, shopping, She's also bilingual. She speaks a lot of languages. She speaks Arabic. She speaks Spanish. So people who wouldn't know how to communicate in their native tongue and get help, now at least we have people with a full spectrum of backgrounds in other languages. So it costs you nothing. Just give a call if you want to avail yourself of it. 212-874-4000. 212-874-4000. We're happy to have Danny Jacobs with us. All of us who are baby boomers grew up being able to play outside. We all built little forts or tree houses. We all engaged in nature. We all got to see what it was like in the woods. And that was a very important part of our development. Today, I watch people in my building, and they're 4 and 5 years old, and they're still in the strollers. Parents picking their kids up and walking from the car into the school, and yet they're 6 years old. I can't imagine this. What message that gives to the kids? Well, this is what George Monbiot has to say about this. In a piece in The Guardian, rewild the child. A week in the countryside is worth 3 months in a classroom. An overview of research into outdoor education by King's College London found that children who spend time learning in natural environments, quote, perform better in reading, mathematics, science, and social studies. Exploring the natural world, quote, makes other school subjects rich and relevant and gets apathetic students excited about learning. Field work in the countryside, a British study finds, improves long-term memory. And dozens of scientific papers report sharp improvements in attention when children are exposed to wildlife and the great outdoors. Teenage girls taken on a 3-week canoeing trip in the U.S. remained, even after 18 months later, more determined, more prepared to speak out and show leadership, and more inclined to challenge conventional notions of femininity. Studies of the programs run by the Wilderness Foundation, United Kingdom, which takes troubled teenagers into the mountains, found that their self-control, their self-awareness, and behavior all improved. And the school's inspection services reports that getting children out of the classroom raises, quote, standards, motivation, personal development, and behavior. Last week, according to George Monbiot, quote, I saw the evidence for myself with the adventure learning charity Wide Horizons. I spent 2 days taking a group of 10-year-olds from a deprived borough in London, rock pooling and roaming the woods in mid-Wales. Many of them had never been to the countryside before and had never seen the sea. I was nervous before I met them. I feared that our differences might set us apart. I thought they may be bored and indifferent. But my fears evaporated as soon as we reached the rock pools. By the way, a rock pool is an area right beside the ocean. Within a few minutes, I had them picking up crabs, and when I showed them that they could eat alive the prawns out of the net, they were horrified. But curiosity and bravado conquered disgust, and one after another, they tried them. And raw prawns are as sweet as grapes. Some of the children were soon shoveling them into their mouths, and I don't think there was anyone in the group who hadn't managed not to fall in the water several times. But no one complained. In the woods the next day, we paddled in a stream, rolled down a hill, ate blackberries, tasted mushrooms, explored an ant's nest, broke sticks, and collected acorns. Most had never done any of these things before. But they needed no encouragement. The exhilaration with which they explored the living world seemed instinctive. I realized just how little contact they had when I discovered that none of them had seen a nettle or knew what happens if you touch it. But what hit me hardest was this. One boy stood out. He had remarkable powers of observation and intuition. When I mentioned this to his teacher, she replied, "Well, I must tell him. It's not something he will have ever heard before." When a child as bright and engaged as this is struggling at school, the problem lies not with the child, but with the educational system. We foster and reward a narrow set of skills. the governments of this country accept the case for outdoor learning. 2006, Departments for Children in Schools, Culture and Environment signed a manifesto which says the following, quote, "We strongly support the educational case for learning outside the classroom. If all young people were given these opportunities, we believe it would make a significant contribution to raising achievement." But the government then cut back spending, massive cuts, and it was over. Why shouldn't every child spend a week in the countryside every term? Why shouldn't everyone be allowed to develop the kind of skills that children I met were learning? Rock climbing, gorge scrambling, caving, night walking, rope walk, and natural history. Getting wet and tired and filthy and cold, immersing yourself metaphorically and literally in the natural world. Surely by these means, you discover more about yourself and the world around you than you do during the 3 months in a classroom. What kind of government would deprive children of this experience? End quote. And that was from George Monbiot. And I would absolutely agree with that. I believe that we should make it an effort to have children's learning camps all over, everywhere, around every city in the United States and town. There's no shortages of wonderful outdoor environments for individuals. We just need to make it a priority. Interesting, when I was down in Texas from 1989 to 1995, I had a ranch in Tioga, Texas, called Healing Springs Ranch. I loved it there. I actually bought it from my brother Howard. He wanted to be a cowboy. And so I figured no better place to be a cowboy than the heart of cowboy country, and that's West Texas. And it was a beautiful environment, and thousands of people in this audience visited there. And they had wonderful experiences. But going on a hayride down old country roads and cross pastures, being able to go on nature walks and identify different herbs, being able to look from the top of a deck out and see coyote and fox and the wilds, they love these things. And even watching my brother and I, as we went around in the morning when the mist was just rising, but it was in the middle of August, so the concrete was warm, but the surrounding air was cool, and there would be water moccasins. And we had to take care of anywhere from 4 to 8 water moccasins a morning. They were fascinated by this. So all these things within nature. But my first year there, I'm sitting out overlooking this 12-acre lake. I'm having some lemonade, and this little bus pulls up. Like a little van. And this woman leans out the window and she says, "Are you the owner?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I'm sorry to impose, but I was told you have some animals here." And I said, "I have some animals." She said, "Well, I've got some kids here and they're physically challenged and I just thought it might be fun if they could see this." And I said, "Well, sure." So we went down and we got them out of the van I took them around the property, and they got to see elk and nilgai and adex and oryx and a large collection of buffalo, about 60 buffalo, and long-haired Scottish cattle. Those are the cows where the hair goes clear down to the ground, beautiful reddish color. Swans and exotic pheasants, peacocks, and chickens from around the world, about 600 of them. They got to see and pet different heifers. They fell in love with these little loving little miniature horses and little miniature cows. And this one big mother cow, who was the friendliest cow I've ever seen in my life, let everybody pet her. And then I took her up with all the kids. There were about 12 kids, and I took them up on the deck. And that's where we had the capuchins, the monkeys, and the ringtail lemurs, which, by the way, are still alive today. They're supposed to live around 12 years. Mine are already 30 years. They've more than doubled their lifespan and are still healthy. So, and I had them out. You know, they were out exploring their environment and sitting there on the chair being, I was hand feeding them grapes. The kids said, "Can they feed them?" So, yeah, the kids were feeding them grapes and laughing. And the kids, their eyes lit up and they were so excited. And And I just kept running back in. I went in, I made lemonade for all of them and brought them out some fruit and what I had. And they had a big time. And finally they said, well, I got to get them back. And she said, there's some other kids around here who, you know, would love to see something like this. And I said, well, sure, you know, happy to. I'm here only in the month of August, but happy to have you come back. Well, little did I know that suddenly every single day throughout the day, vans, buses of kids would come. Thousands came. And we would then, had to have Larry and Howard, my brother, and Stephen, my other brother, take them on tours. And they would take them around and show them. It just became wonderful. So I believe that children really thrive when they're around animals, not for eating, but for loving, around nature, to see it as it is, and to have someone teach them the lessons where they can actually enjoy themselves in the process. Just a thought. Also, this is from Harvard. Turns out Harvard University researchers analyzed the National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey and the National Hospital Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, determined, quote, that doctors prescribe antibiotics in 60% of visits for sore throats and 73% of visits for acute bronchitis, and that doesn't work. There's no efficacy. Zero for acute bronchitis. And so what it means is, quote, antibiotics are drastically overprescribed and effectiveness is threatened. And this was published in the Journal of American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. Now, for years, I've been saying that you shouldn't be getting an antibiotic for everything unless it's something that's absolutely proven that your condition will benefit from that antibiotic. A cold, a flu, it's not going to benefit. And yet they continue to give them, and that only harms you, and that's not good. Also, from our environmental segment today, this has to do with the XL pipeline. This is from Sharon Guinep of whowhatwhy.com. I'll just give a little bit of it. It says the following. Debate continues to rage over whether the Obama administration should approve the TransCanada Corporation's contentious Keystone XL pipeline. Meanwhile, little attention is focused on the impact of tar sands oil spills in far-flung states. Two accidents in Arkansas and Michigan raise largely unaddressed questions about the true cost to human health and the environment, and the high cost and difficulty of cleanup. But there are other issues as well, ranging from the political and economic impact to the behavior of the corporations involved in the very nature of the substance itself. The more recent of these disasters came March 29th when a 22-foot gash opened in ExxonMobil's 65-year-old Pegasus pipeline. It dumped 210,000 gallons of tar sand oil into the streets of Mayflower, Arkansas, and into a nearby Lake Conway. More than 6 months after that lake of Vicus tar sand crude engulfed a subdivision, many homes, both within the core spill and at the periphery, stand deserted. Among the few inhabitants who remain are those too old or too poor to leave. And while many others simply have no place else to go, the streets are dotted with for sale signs that beckon no buyers. Many people are ill, suffering from respiratory problems, chronic headaches, debilitating fatigue, and other complaints. Environmental scientist Wilma Subra says the symptoms are consistent with known effects from exposure to petroleum products and to the volatile chemicals used to dilute the gummy Canadian oil so it can flow through a pipeline. While cleanup continues, the legal battles have just begun. Among them are class action and civil lawsuits, plus a lawsuit filed by the U.S. Justice Department and the state of Arkansas for alleged violations of state and federal environmental laws, including the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. And ExxonMobil lied about what spilled. For weeks after the spill, ExxonMobil withheld crucial information about the nature of their product from state and local officials. The oil giant insisted It was conventional crude, which is cheaper and easier to clean up, while downplaying the amount of and extent of contamination. Early on, company officials claimed that nearby Lake Conway was oil-free, though internal emails showed they knew otherwise. Far to the north, 40 miles of Michigan's Kalamazoo River shimmered with a slick rainbow sheen. It's the toxic legacy of the largest, most expensive onshore spill in U.S. history. And it erupted in July 26, 2010, and they still haven't got it cleaned up. But that is what happens. And then it goes on to talk about what is the likelihood of these spills happening all over the United States. And the answer is easily, and we don't have the money or resources to clean it up. So we shouldn't be allowing it in the first place. And I would agree with that. And also, pharmaceutical firms paid, this is just incredible, paid to attend meetings that advises the FDA. This is from Peter Wierschke, and here's what it says from the Washington Post. A scientific panel that shaped the federal government's policy for testing the safety and efficacy of painkillers was funded by major pharmaceutical companies that paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for the chance to affect the thinking of the Food and Drug Administration, according to hundreds of emails obtained by a public records request. The emails show that the companies paid as much as $25,000 to attend any given meeting of the panel, which had been set up by two academics to provide advice to the FDA on how to weigh the evidence for clinical trials. A leading FDA official later called the group, quote, an essentially collaborative effort. Patient advocacy groups said the electronic communications suggested the regulators had become too close to the companies trying to crack into the $9 billion painkiller market in the United States. So what it means is this in lay language. It means that when you think the government is examining the evidence on a painkiller or any drug to see, is this really safe? Is this effective? Let's have independent scientific review. None of that. Not an iota of that is true. The people manufacturing the drugs will then tell the FDA what the standard should be for efficacy and safety. They then provide the experts who are paid by the industry. The experts then vouch for the safety and efficacy and argue the case before any panel. And then many times the very members of the FDA go to work for the company involved. I consider this terrible behavior. So here's the bottom line. You cannot, under any circumstances, believe anything that the FDA says because they are so compromised, so biased, all the time. And that caused us to have 60,000 to 500,000 Americans, 60,000 to 500,000 Americans die from one drug in a four-year period. The whistleblower, Dr. Graham, inside the FDA, saw the problem, knew it, and the FDA covered it up and banished him. I interviewed him twice. I filmed him for Prescription for Disaster. And there he was telling the truth. But no one else at the FDA would tell the truth. They got away with mass murder. They killed 60,000 Americans. The stock in the company went up. The head of the company got a raise. No one was held accountable. That's how the Clinton-Obama Democrats and the Bush Republicans protect their own. Who's protecting your interest? There is a desire by tens of millions of Americans lumped into a diffuse and fractious movement known as the Christian right. We've talked about it many times on this program. What is their intent? To destroy the intellectual and scientific rigor of the Enlightenment. Radically diminish the role of government to create a theocratic state based upon biblical law and force a recalcitrant world to bend to the will of an imperial and Christian America. Its public face is on display in the House of Representatives. This ideology, which is the driving force behind the shutdown of the government, calls for the eradication of social deviance, beginning with gay men and lesbians, whose sexual orientation, those in the movement say, is a curse and an illness, contaminating the American family and the country. So once these deviants are removed, other deviants, including Muslims, progressives, liberals, feminists, intellectuals, left-wing activists, and undocumented workers, poor African Americans, and those dismissed as nominal Christians, meaning Christians who do not embrace this peculiar interpretation of the Bible, will also be ruthlessly repressed. The deviant government bureaucrats, the deviant media, the deviant schools, the deviant churches, they believe are all agents of Satan, and they'll be crushed or radically reformed. Now, the rights of these deviants will be annulled. Christian values and family values will, in the new state, be propagated by all institutions. Education and social welfare will be handed over to the church. Facts and self-criticism will be replaced by relentless indoctrination. Now, according to Chris Hedges, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, whose father, by the way, was Rafael Cruz, and he is a rabid right-wing Christian preacher. He's also the director of the Purifying Fire International Ministry. They have legions of the senator's wealthy supporters, some of whom orchestrated the shutdown, are rooted in a radical Christian ideology known as Dominionism or Christian Reconstructionism. And this ideology calls for an anointed Christian leaders to take over the state and make the goals and laws of the nation biblical. It seems to reduce government to organizing little more than defense, internal security, and protection of property rights. It fuses with the Christian religion, the language of American imperialism and nationalism, along with the cruelest aspects of corporate capitalism. The intellectual and moral hollowness of the ideology is its flagrant distortion and misuse of the Bible, the contradictions that abound within it. Its leaders champion small government and a large military, as if the military is no part of the government. And its laughable pseudoscience are impervious to reason and fact. And that is why it is so dangerous. Now, as an aside, for those of you who heard last night's Progressive Commentary Hour, I'm now doing a series on bureaucracies. Any reasonable and responsible person knows that we need a viable government. We need a government that supports our rights, that protects our rights, and that ensures that the products and services we receive are for our benefit, hence the protection of our food supply, for example. But there's a difference between needing a responsible and a quality government versus monster bureaucracies like the military intelligence bureaucracies and the medical industrial bureaucracies and the financial bureaucracies. These do not benefit us. They have grown abnormal, and they are causing us great fear. So we address these. I had an insider from the Defense Department and the State Department last night explaining the corruption that has occurred, how it's occurred, who has supported it, and what we can do to challenge it. I had someone who is the leading challenger of the Internal Revenue Service give us a different perspective on that. Each week I'll be doing different bureaucracies because I believe that we have to have scholars in who are from these industries, who are whistleblowers, who tell us the truth so we do not become hyperbolizing an issue. We become restrained and show you what is happening. And in all of this, I hear the Sean Hannitys, the Bill O'Reillys, the Mark Levin talk about a strong defense. And it was shown last night that we don't need $1.5 trillion for defense, maybe $200 billion. And the rest is going to special interest groups. And yet the Christian right supports this, but they do not support the other social programs. They don't support refocusing on education. They don't support the infrastructural improvements that are necessary in the United States. In fact, what they do support is a cult of masculinity. As in all fascist movements, it pervades the ideology of the Christian right. The movement uses religion to sanctify military and heroic virtues. They glorify blind obedience and order over reason and conscience, and they pander to the euphoria of collective emotions. Feminism and homosexuality, believers are told, have rendered the American male physically and spiritually impotent. Jesus, for the Christian right, is a man of action, casting out demons, battling the Antichrist, attacking hypocrites, and ultimately slaying non-believers. Now, this cult of masculinity, with its glorification of violence, is appealing to the powerless. It stokes the anger of many Americans, mostly white and economically disadvantaged, and encourages them to lash back at those who they are told seek to destroy them. The paranoia about the outside world is fostered by bizarre conspiracy theories, many of which are prominent in the rhetoric of those leading the government shutdown. Believers, especially now, are called to a perpetual state of war with the secular humanist state. The march, they believe, is irreversible. Global war, even nuclear war, is the joyful harbinger of the second coming. And leading the avenging armies is an angry, violent Messiah who dooms billions of apostates to death. Well, take a look carefully. These people believe they are engaged in an epic battle against the forces of Satan. They live in a binary world of black and white. They feel they are victims surrounded by sinister groups bent on their destruction. They have anointed themselves as agents of gods who all alone know God's will. They sanctify their rage. This rage lies in the center of their ideology. It leaves them sputtering inanities about Barack Obama, his corporate-sponsored health care reform, his alleged mandated suicide counseling on death panels for seniors. They see the government bureaucracy as being controlled by secular humanists who want to destroy the family and make war against the purity of their belief systems. They seek total cultural and political domination. In conclusion, all ideological, theological, and political debates with the radical Christian right are useless. It cares nothing for rational thought and discussion, not a whiff. Its adherents are using the space within the open society to destroy the open society itself. Our naive attempts to placate a movement bent on our destruction, to prove it to that we have our values, only strengthens their supposed legitimacy, increases our own weakness. Dominionists have to operate for now in what they see as the contaminated environment of secular liberal state. They work with the rest of us only because they must. Given enough power, and they are working hard to get it, any such cooperation will vanish. There is no different mindset from the vanguard described by Lenin or the Islamic terrorists who shaved off their beards, adopted Western dress, watched pay-per-view pornography in their hotel rooms the night before hijacking a plane for a suicide attack. The elect alone, like the Grand Inquisitor, are sanctioned to know the truth. They believe, and in the pursuit of their truth, they have no moral constraints. We have abandoned our poor and our working class. We have created a government monster that sucks the marrow out of our bones to enrich and empower the oligarch and corporate elite. The protection of criminals, whether in war or Wall Street, is part of our mirage of law and order. We have betrayed the vast and growing underclass. Most believers within the Christian right are struggling to survive in a hostile world. We have failed them. Their real despair is being manipulated and used by Christian fascists. And give to the working poor a living wage, benefits, and job security, and the reach of this movement will diminish. Refuse to ameliorate the suffering of the poor and the working class, and you ensure the ascendancy of Christian fascism. The Christian right needs only a spark to set it ablaze. Another catastrophic act of domestic terrorism, hyperinflation, a series of devastating droughts, floods, hurricanes, or massive wildfires, or another financial meltdown will be the trigger. Then what is left of our anemic open society will disintegrate. The rise of Christian fascism is aided by our complacency. The longer we fail to openly denounce and defy bankrupt liberalism, the longer we permit corporate power to plunder the nation and destroy the ecosystem, the longer we stand slack-jawed before the open gates of the city, waiting meekly for the barbarians, the more we ensure their arrival. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you very much for listening. Now let's say hello to you, Therese Lead. Hi, you, Therese.
Hello, Gary. Today it is open forum, so listeners dictate where the conversation goes, as usual.
We look forward to it right now on Nutrice Leads. Lead Time.
You